Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Good day, this is Glenn. I'll be reading from the Cowboys and Indians magazine for the May-June 2023 edition. Good day, I'm Glenn, and I'll be reading to you today from the May-June 2023 issue of Cowboys and Indians. The article I'll be reading right now is River of a Mother's Love. A poignant boat trip with the Nez Perce in Idaho elicits memories of mothers and makes unexpected and profound connections among strangers afloat together, by Matt Crossman. The boat stopped in front of a sandy stretch of beach along the Snake River near Lewiston, Idaho. A man named Jeffrey Scott stood up. He's Nez Perce, also known as Nimiipuu, and the boat had arrived at an important place in his ancestral history. He told a long story about the beach, tracing his forebears from there to an encounter with Lewis and Clark, to Sitting Bull's camp in the mid-1800s to modern-day Lewiston. I studied him while we were aboard the River Leader as he gave an impromptu speech during the cultural Hear the Echoes of Our Ancestors jet boat tour. His cracked hands had obviously seen hard work. His face, weathered and taut, had spent many hours in the sun and wind. His personal history lesson turned into a heartbreaking and funny tribute to his mother, who had died a few months earlier. He sounded like I felt when I gave my mom's eulogy less than a year before. Scott said his mom spoke the Nez Perce language, Nimiipuutimt, and he didn't. When she spoke it in front of him, he knew somehow that she was talking about him. He smiled at that memory, a smile that gave the rest of us on the River Leader permission to laugh as we wondered what our moms would say about us if they spoke a language that we couldn't understand. Scott walked toward the front of the River Leader. He said he wanted to sing a goodbye song to her. The captain maneuvered the boat until it was perpendicular to shore, then he cut the engines. The 48 passengers had excitedly chitter-chattered for the hour we had spent on the boat. We had gaped at bald eagles, marveled at bighorn sheep, laughed as a huge flock of pelicans flew by. Now nobody talked. The whole world stopped making noise. All eyes focused on Scott. As he spoke, Stacia Morphin, chief executive officer of Nez Perce Tourism, which owns the River Leader, looked on. Decked out in full Nimiipuu regalia, she wore a dress made of skin from mountain sheep like the ones that live along the river. She founded the company to preserve and celebrate Nimiipuu culture and traditions. Her goal is to give cultural tourists real, lasting, and important experiences. This maiden voyage of the River Leader was as real, lasting, and important as it gets. "Welcome home," Morphin told Scott, her uncle, and hugged him. "We really are in a beautiful place of healing." Morphin's Nimiipuu name is Kushnium Quixnuit, which means one who takes care of water. And now the water was taking care of us. On the far side of the boat, a woman was transfixed, her blue eyes glistening. The man across from me wiped his. It was the day before Mother's Day, and this son, who loved his mother and missed her desperately, started to sing. I travel for many reasons, to grow, to learn, to embrace adventure, and to escape, especially on trips in which I write about Native American cultures. I love connecting with people whose ancestry and background, and their sense of pride in celebrating those two things, are different from mine. My trip to Idaho started out as a way to learn about the Coeur d'Alene tribe and Nimiipuu people, cultures, and histories, and I did. But it became about so much more than that. In a powerful, unmistakable, and almost eerie way, I found connection again and again through our shared sorrow and pain, and also through shared beauty. Northern Idaho in May is as green as an Irish postcard. Over a 5-day trip, I hiked in that green lushness, jogged in it, drove in it, rode a horse in it, hit golf balls in it, sped in a boat in it, and marveled at it all the while. Wheat, grains, garbanzo beans, and other crops rolled along hills, ending in the distant dark green of ponderosa fir forests. Every time I mentioned my amazement at their state's greenness to Idahoans, I heard the same response, given with a knowing sign resignation. It'll turn brown in June. Fair enough, I suppose, but it also revealed a truth of travel. Sometimes an outsider appreciates a place's beauty more than someone who lives there. Appreciate it now, because it will be gone soon, became a lesson from the green, and so much more. At the outset, my mood was more brown than green. Anxiety gnawed at me when I arrived at the Chief Joseph Foundation near Lewiston. Since leaving home a few days earlier, I had learned that our landlord was selling our house, and my wife, two kids, and I had to rush to find a new place to live. House hunting in St. Louis is difficult enough. House hunting in St. Louis when you're in Idaho is all but ridiculous. The market for buyers and renters were both bad. I hoped horseback riding in Lewiston would provide respite from that stress. I can't ride a horse and worry at the same time. Nobody can. Rain pounded the roof as I arrived at the Chief Joseph Foundation, named for the Nimi Pew leader who guided the tribe during its most tumultuous period, when violent encounters with settlers forced them to flee north in 1877. Bonnie Ewing greeted me. She and her husband Bill started the foundation because they wanted kids from difficult backgrounds to feel the powerful connection between horse and rider. Bonnie and I stood outside the foundation's small arena. She beamed at a sign on the front of the building. The foundation had kicked around ideas of what to call the building. As far as she knew, at the time, no decision had been made. When it came to formally open the building, Bonnie, who was mourning Bill's death, did not want to go to the ceremony. She eventually allowed herself to be talked into it. She was speechless when the sign was uncovered. Ewing Arena, it said, dedicated to Bill and Bonnie Ewing. Oh, man, says Mike Ewing, Bill and Bonnie's son. She lost it. Mike Ewing was my guide, and he agreed to take me for a ride, rain or not. Normally, the way to end a drought is for me to plan a camping trip there, but the rain stopped shortly after we arrived at Spalding Park. I told Mike Ewing my housing sob story and said I was glad to be on a horse so I didn't have time to think about it. Then I changed the subject, or thought I did, at least. What is it, I asked him from atop an Appaloosa named Happy, about kids and horses that is so powerful? He spun around from atop his horse named Quick to face me. It's exactly what you just said, he said. Many of the kids come from troubled backgrounds. Their stress is more permanent and powerful than mine, but the horses provide the same balm for them as they did for me. They can forget about that for a while. The people known as Coeur d'Alene call themselves Skatoomish, which means discovered people. French traders gave them the name Coeur d'Alene, which means heart of an awl, because they were sharp traders. I rode shotgun as Leanne Campbell, the cultural tourism coordinator for the Coeur d'Alene Casino, drove us across rolling hills on the way to the tribe's Eagle Aviary, the first such facility in the Pacific Northwest. The aviary is 75 feet long, 24 feet wide, and 16 feet tall. Inside are a pond, waterfalls, and climbing perches. One of the loudest and most aggressive birds is a bald eagle named Makin, which would never fly again. Across from her, on the other side of the aviary, sat Achatok, which means blind. She was a female golden eagle, and at 13 pounds is the largest bird in the aviary. I watched as huge slabs of fish were placed inside the aviary. There was a pecking order to eating that the eagle somehow knew to follow. On the day I visited, all the birds eyed the food for 5, 10, 15 minutes. Maybe they didn't want to eat in front of a stranger. As they sat on their perches, the birds looked majestic, regal, stern, powerful, and fully clothed. Sometimes you come here and there's no feathers on the ground, said Vince Pion, a tribal wildlife official who helped build the aviary, and the next day there's 10 or 15. Many Native American tribes revere eagles because they fly as high and close to the Creator as any animal, Campbell told me. That makes their feathers valuable, and to receive one is to receive a kingly gift. They are given as rites of passages, as symbols of respect, and simply out of love. Like any gift, the most prized eagle feathers have heart-rending stories behind them. For Pion, that story is about a feather he gave away. On Father's Day in 2014, Vincent went salmon fishing in Alaska with his father, Sam Pion. Sitting in a drift boat, they threw their lines in the water. An eagle attacked a seagull. When the eagle flew away, a feather fell off it. Father and son watched, dumbfounded, as it slowly drifted down. It's a huge blessing if you just find them in the wild, Vince Pion said, and to see one fall right in front of you as you're pulling salmon out of the river with your dad on Father's Day, the Pions almost couldn't believe what they were seeing. They paddled the drift boat to where the feather landed, and Vince Pion plucked it out of the water. I grabbed it, I lifted it up, and I said some prayers, he said. He gave the father to his feather, and Sam Pion proudly displayed it at his home for the rest of his life. He died of COVID in February 2022. His casket was full of eagle feathers, an unmistakable sign of the respect he commanded. But that special feather, the one the son gave to his father, was nowhere to be found. Vince knows he will never see it again, but he'll never forget it either. I flew out for this assignment a few days early to see my cousins in Spokane, just over the Washington border from Coeur d'Alene. Their mom, my aunt, died a few months after my mom died. So did the mom of the editor who assigned this story. And after talking with Vince Pion and Mike Ewing about the deaths of their fathers, my heart was attuned to sorrow and pain. Scott's comments and songs squeezed me like a python. I wanted to walk across the boat and hug him and tell him not that everything would be okay, but that the pain shows how much he loved her, and that in my case that love was worth the pain that followed, and I hoped it would be the same for him. But I didn't do that. I wish I had. Nez Perce is an Americanization of the French phrase for pierced nose. They call themselves Nimi Pew, which means the people. They did not pierce their noses. There are a couple explanations for the name. One says a French fur trader saw a woman from a different tribe, and she had a pierced nose, which was common among her people. The Frenchman mistook her for Nemipu and mislabeled an entire people based on that. Another is that the term Nez Perce arose from a misunderstood hand gesture. There was no misunderstanding what was happening on the boat. It was a deeply personal and simultaneously universal catharsis happening in public. Scott's song comprised some words in Nemiputment and some sounds that transcended language. I could not understand the words. I did not have to. His mournful lament crossed all borders of culture and language. I felt Scott's pain as he talked and sang. I thought of my mom, of course. I wanted to call her to tell her that I had to move and about the incredibly powerful song I heard on a boat in Idaho. That wouldn't be possible, but something in the cadence of the music and the movement of the river told me she already knew. A Hero for All Times by Heidi Brandis. In 1924, Oklahoma's favorite son, Will Rogers, was already a star. As a trick roper, a vaudeville comedian, and a political satirist, Rogers captivated an entire nation with his wit, good nature, and a spot-on commentary on human nature and politics. That same popularity drove him to publish The Illiterate Digest, a humor-filled collection of lectures, speeches, and commentary for which Rogers was famous. Now, nearly 100 years later, the book is just as relevant as it was a century earlier. Rogers once famously said, "I never met a man I didn't like," and the feeling was mutual. When The Illiterate Digest turns 100 in 2024, it will pay tribute to a man who at one time was the most popular person in the world. However, despite his legacy as the top radio personality, the number one box office draw, the nation's most popular and in-demand public speaker, and the most read newspaper columnist in history, the memory of Rogers and how he helped shape America is slowly sliding into the hazy forgetfulness of history. Today, there are very, very few people alive who remember Will. So everybody who comes here now is coming because they've heard about Will from their grandparents, or they come because they know their grandparents love Will, says Tad Jones, executive director of the Will Rogers Memorial Museum in Claremore, Oklahoma. Will Rogers was a great citizen role model, and part of what we do here at the Will Rogers Museum is to show what kind of person he was. Most people are amazed at what a big star he was. Long after his untimely death in 1935 in a plane crash that also took the life of famed Oklahoma aviator Wiley Post, Rogers continues to influence popular culture, political commentary, and even health care. Museums and foundations such as the Will Rogers Museum are on a mission to perpetuate his history and accomplishments, but every year keeping that legacy alive and relevant grows harder and harder. Will Rogers was many things: comedian, newspaper columnist, author of numerous books, and philanthropist. He was a top box office draw for both silent movies and traditional movies, making him among the first to become a true movie star. But it was his personality that drove his enormous popularity. Although his commentary and aw shucks wit could be sharp at times, he managed to deliver a stark, incisive look at the world without being malicious or ugly. The whole world grieved after Rogers and Post's plane went down near Point Barrow, Alaska, killing both American heroes on August 15, 1935. Rogers was honored in a manner usually reserved for presidents and heroes. Congress led out for the day in respect, federal buildings and banks closed, and radio shows went silent. Flags were flown at half-staff, and more than 12,000 motion picture theater screens went dark for 2 minutes at 2 p.m. on August 22, 1935, in tribute. Why was he so appealing to so many people? Jones knows why. He worked hard. He treated people with respect. He looked at the good in people. He didn't take things too personally. He laughed. These are the things that made a good person like Will Rogers, and we think that's a great story to share with kids today. We share that if you can implement these traits, then you can succeed, have good friendships, and have a good and fulfilling life as Will Rogers did. People all over the world appreciated him. It didn't matter your race, religion, ethnic background, or income levels, Jones says. Everybody loved Will Rogers. William Penn Adair Rogers was always a capricious child. Born on Election Day, November 4, 1879, in Indian Territory, the youngest of 8 children, Will was destined to be a comedian and showman. He would often get in trouble for roping girls at school, and his father was so fed up with his antics that he was eventually enrolled in military school. He never got past the 10th grade, but he did have a passion for learning, and he became an avid reader. But when he was growing up, he loved roping and loved being a cowboy, Jones says. After school, Will took over his father's Dog Iron Ranch, but after 3 years, he reckoned he wasn't one for the business side of running a ranch. He sold the ranch back to his father and dedicated to try his hand at being a gaucho in Argentina in 1902. He went to Argentina with a friend, but Will's friend went back home, so Will was by himself, Jones says. Will got on a boat with a bunch of cattle and headed to South Africa instead. Bad luck seemed to follow the young cowboy, who found himself broke in Africa. However, when things happened to go wrong, Will always found a way to bounce back. He saw a sign for the Texas Jacks Wild West Show advertising a performing position for someone who could do trick roping. As a lifelong trick roper, Will found his first showbiz job, and he was good at it too, becoming a well-known performer on the Wild West show circuits. In 1905, he moved to New York City with his trick roping act, and for 50 weeks a year, according to a 1915 New York Times article, he performed for various vaudeville theaters. He also married his childhood sweetheart, Betty Blake, on November 25, 1908. In fact, it was Betty who suggested Will add comedy and political satire to his shows. That's when his star just took off, Jones says. He became like Jay Leno or Jimmy Fallon or Johnny Carson. He hosted a show every night that was unique. Everyone couldn't wait to see who Will was going to make fun of that night. In 1915, Rogers signed on with Florence Ziegfeld's Midnight Frolic and went on to star with the Ziegfeld Follies on Broadway in 1916. With his success in the Follies and his natural charisma, Will branched out to become an actor, starring in his first silent movie, Laughing Bill Hyde, in 1918. He starred in 50 silent films and 21 talkies, becoming one of the first true movie stars alongside Charlie Chaplin. Charlie Chaplin was the top in the silent movies, and Will did what they call the talkies, said Todd Vandenberg, executive director at the Will Rogers Motion Picture Pioneers Foundation. He also had a popular daily syndicated column, authored 6 books, including The Illiterate Digest, and had one of the most popular radio shows in the world. He was even nominated for governor of Oklahoma, which he declined. He was a commentator who had the most popular daily syndicated column in the country, writing more than 4,000 nationally syndicated newspaper columns in his life. He called politics the best show in the world and described Congress as the national joke factory, according to CMGWW.com, the official website of Will Rogers. His folksy humor and honest, intelligent observations about the government and America earned the respect of the nation. Adventure still roared through Will's blood, and as a journalist and an aviator, he helped develop the United States Air Force. So when he and Post joined forces to fly to Alaska to discover a new mail route in 1935, no one had to think twice. On August 15, 1935, Will and Wiley's plane crashed near Point Barrow, taking both of their lives. The world reeled with shock and mourned the loss of their favorite son. After Will's untimely death, Will's wife, Betty, built a memorial in Claremore, Oklahoma, which was dedicated in 1938 by President Franklin Roosevelt. Though he was laid to rest in California, Will's body was moved in 1944 to rest at the Will Rogers Memorial Museum, along with his son, Fred, who died at age 2. That same year, Betty passed away, and she joined her husband and son in Claremore. Will Rogers' home and 359-acre ranch in California were donated by Betty to the California State Parks, and in 1944, Will Rogers State Historic Park was created. Its 31-room ranch house came complete with a stable, corrals, a riding ring, polo field, golf course, roping arena, and riding trails. A short ride to the west is Will Rogers State Beach, stretching along the Pacific just north of Los Angeles. A state park isn't the only legacy to bear Will's name. In 1936, a tuberculosis hospital in Saranac, New York, that housed vaudeville performers who were ill was renamed the Will Rogers Hospital, and the Foundation of Motion Picture Pioneers, FMPP, was created as a management organization to take care of the hospital. The hospital was a tuberculosis treatment center all the way up until about the late 50s. Once tuberculosis got under control, the foundation expanded into other pulmonary issues like emphysema and bronchitis, Vandenberg says. In 2002, the FMPP merged with the Will Rogers Memorial Fund to create the Will Rogers Motion Picture Pioneers Foundation, expanding into the most meaningful charities with ties to the film industry. Another indelible mark on the culture, in 1952, Route 66 was dedicated as the Will Rogers Memorial Highway after the movie The Will Rogers Story debuted. It starred Will Rogers Jr. playing his dad, and the entire cast drove from Chicago to Santa Monica along the famed Mother Road in honor of Will. Jennifer Rogers Echeverry, Will's great-granddaughter, is among those fighting to keep the legacy of Will Rogers alive. As social media grows and time passes, she finds less and less is said about America's favorite son. I grew up in New Mexico and he wasn't really talked about much in our family, Rogers Echeverry says. I was in grammar school and back then you learned about people like him in your history books. I remember learning a little bit about him in school and traveling to California or Oklahoma on vacations to visit the museum or have an event. But it really wasn't until 1991, when the Will Rogers Follies debuted on Broadway that I truly even understood who he was and the magnitude that he had. Rogers Echeverry is one of the founders of the foundation in California Pacific Palisades that supports Will Rogers State Historic Park. The foundation board raises funds that stay strictly at that park. It stuns me that people don't know who Will Rogers is, but I guess time marches on. It's hard, and that's my job and role as the family spokesperson. I just want to keep his legacy alive. And she wants to keep it true to the man. People approach me the time wanting to do a documentary or do a film about Will Rogers. They want to throw in scandal, but they can't find any scandal on Will Rogers, she says. He really was just a good old boy. There hasn't been anyone before or since that is or was as loved as Will Rogers. More about America's favorite son. Learn about America's favorite son at various museums and sites throughout America, including the Will Rogers Birthplace Ranch in Ooliga, Oklahoma, the home where Will Rogers was born on the 400-acre living ranch. Efforts to preserve Rogers' memory and legacy continue, most recently with a formal agreement between the Cherokee Nation and the Oklahoma Historical Society. In November 2020, the Cherokee Nation purchased Will Rogers' home and family ranch in northeastern Oklahoma from the Oklahoma Historical Society with plans to renovate and restore the historic property. He was called the Cherokee Kid in his early entertainment career and always embraced his culture and his tribe. No matter how popular he was, Will Rogers was always a Cherokee, and he talked about it. He reminded people every day that there are Native people of this land still alive and who remain a vibrant part of America's tapestry. It is quite fitting that the Cherokee Nation will now have an opportunity to continue telling this story from such a unique perspective, Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskins Jr. said in a written statement. Of course, the Will Rogers Memorial Museum in Claremore is the resting place of Will Rogers and includes the largest collection of Will Rogers memorabilia in the world and all his writings. The museum also has 12 galleries, a children's museum, theater, and library. And finally, in January of this year, OU Press reissued Will Rogers and His America by Gary Clayton Anderson with a new afterword by the author, along with study and discussion questions for every chapter, explaining in its catalog that although Rogers is remembered today for his success in vaudeville and the nascent American film industry, history has largely forgotten his considerable influence as a political commentator, an aspect of Rogers' life that Gary Clayton Anderson explores at length in this brief but complete biography.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading an article that's from the True West Magazine's archives, the May 1988 edition. Private Gay and the Battle That Shouldn't Have Been Fought by Jacqueline Dorgan McKetta. When young Albert L. Gay headed west on the Santa Fe Trail in the spring of 1847, he really had nothing more in mind than earning a good salary as a civilian teamster in the employment of the Army quartermaster. He also figured the job would be an excellent way to get a look at the new territory out west, which had just been liberated from Mexico, with an eye toward finding an ideal spot, perhaps to settle and farm. He certainly did not anticipate fighting in a bloody and totally unnecessary battle. Gay, born in the early 1820s in New York State, was adventurous, intelligent, and literate. After he arrived in Santa Fe, Gay was sent to a grazing camp 25 miles from town, where he and other teamsters guarded the government mules and oxen from marauding Indians. During that period, there were some problems between a few of the Missouri volunteer soldiers, who were a notoriously rowdy bunch, and some of the natives of the newly occupied territory. As a result of a fight, some of the soldiers were killed, and the military in turn hunted down and killed or took prisoner a number of local Mexicans. Gay, as an American and an Army employee, could have expected to take a very biased view of those events. In fact, he showed remarkable open-mindedness in his letters to his parents in Rochester. He wrote, "I must announce, after having some little opportunity of judging of their character and disposition, that the Mexicans are not as bad as our countrymen represent them in the States. In fact, there are two sides to every question, and it is true that some few parties of volunteers have been inhumanely murdered by them. But in every case, the volunteers were the aggressors. Volunteers and Teamsters are dispersed over various parts of the country, herding and, not infrequently, turning their animals upon the Mexicans' corn and wheat, and when politely asked to remove them, would tell the Mexicans to help themselves if they could. In vain, they would tell the volunteers that if their corn and wheat was destroyed, they must starve, for that was their only resource. Gay also told his parents that he frequently visited the local people at their homes, where he was always treated with the utmost kindness, and that he had learned to speak the Spanish language pretty well. 3 months after his arrival in Santa Fe, Albert Gay enlisted in a volunteer company of dragoons, becoming a private in Captain Groves's Company B Santa Fe Rifles. The Mexican-American War was still in progress, and Gay wrote to his parents that he would probably go to Chihuahua, Mexico, which Colonel Alexander Doniphan had captured 5 months earlier in March 1847. Gay would indeed see Chihuahua, but not for 7 months, and he would see Indian country first. His mother worried when she learned of his enlistment, wrote to a family member, "I fear before he is again at liberty, he will find something harder to do than he ever did before. I hope he may live to return, but it is very doubtful." At first, Private Gay found military life very agreeable. In August, he wrote that he was being paid $8 per month for his service, $12 for his horse, and that he was expecting $6 for forage and $1 for the use of his rifle, a total of $27 per month. He said they drilled morning and evening, and he had to stand guard only once every 10 days. As a result of having so much free time, he began attending the only school in New Mexico. It was taught in Spanish and attended by 20 boys, all excellent scholars from the more affluent first families of Santa Fe. Gay was not complimentary about anything else in Santa Fe, though. He wrote, "Of all places, this is the beat for gambling and licentiousness, drinking not being accepted. In fact, every house in town is a whorehouse or a grog shop." Private Gay's idyllic military life was short-lived. By September 1st, his company and two others had left the city on an expedition against the troublesome Navajos. They followed the Rio Grande south for 75 miles and then turned westward, marching about 100 miles to a point where they had to leave their wagons. From there, they pushed on to the Pueblo of Zuni, and after a short stop there, continued more than 100 miles to the Canyon de Chelly, the Navajo stronghold in what is now northeastern Arizona. After that long and laborious march, the troops were virtually out of provisions. Even worse, in an area they believed held 5,000 fighting men, they could not find a single Indian. Finally, completely out of food, they marched to the mouth of the canyon, hoping to find some sheep or other livestock to eat. Instead, they found a small group of Navajos, who managed to outwit them and escape. After several days without food, Gay's unit found an Indian mule and several dogs, which they devoured. The following day, a lieutenant and 24 men, including Gay, were ordered to return the 125 miles to Zuni and obtain provisions which could be sent back to the starving troops. They arrived so weak they could barely stand, but were treated kindly by the friendly Zunis, who also dispatched food to their half-famished companions. After their unsuccessful Indian campaign, the troops made their way back to the Rio Grande, where they remained, awaiting a train of provisions from Santa Fe. It was now November, and they learned that Mexico City had fallen to the American army in September. Private Gay and his companions expected that peace would soon be declared. They figured they would never have to see Mexico. But the war was not over yet, and throughout the winter, General Sterling Price, military governor of New Mexico, kept some troops at Socorro and others at Albuquerque. But southern points from which he could quickly and easily put them on the march to Mexico if he received word from Washington to do so. The War Department, however, had decided that Price should attack only if he learned that an enemy force had been organized in Chihuahua with the design of marching on New Mexico. Throughout the winter, American merchants and newspapers in Santa Fe kept pressuring Price to mount an expedition against the Mexicans. Their interest was purely mercenary, for Chihuahua was a trading center, but their desire paralleled Price's own inclination. The justification to attack presented itself in early February 1848. Rumors began flying north from the El Paso area that a Mexican general was advancing on the city with an army of thousands. The information reached Socorro, where Gay's unit and several others were stationed. On February 2nd, several days before word reached General Price, 140 miles further north in Santa Fe. Without waiting for orders from the Santa Fe headquarters, the companies at Socorro took up the line of march for El Paso to assist the approximately 500 American soldiers there. Private Gay managed to write a brief letter to his parents before departing. In it, he mentioned that within a few days, they might all be whipped and killed, but said that personally, he had no notion of dying. Albert Gay was right. When the troops arrived at El Paso, all was peaceful. The rumor had been nothing more than that, a rumor. Sadly enough, the rumor, along with the slow communications of the time, set off a chain of events which would result in needless suffering and death. 2 days before General Price received word of the purported enemy march on El Paso, a peace treaty had been signed by the United States and Mexico at Guadalupe Hidalgo, a suburb of Mexico City. Within days, the governors of the Mexican states were notified that the fighting was over. Price, of course, knew nothing of this, but when he arrived with more troops in El Paso in late February 1848, he learned there was no Mexican force advancing on the city. He also received a dispatch from Washington, which, although written the previous November, nevertheless forbade him to proceed south. Price decided to ignore the dispatch, an action which had terrible consequences. Price had to wait in El Paso for his supply trains to arrive, but determined to have his fight, he began operations immediately. To cut off enemy communications to and from Chihuahua City, he quickly dispatched some of his best-mounted troops, three companies of volunteers, to Corizal, 90 miles to the south. Private Gay was in this first group to cross the border under the command of Major R. Walker. On March 4th, the impatient General Price, still without supplies, crossed into Mexico and joined Walker. The next day, the combined force left at sunrise and rode 40 miles through a cold rain. Pressing on, the following day, they were up at daybreak and made a wearying 50-mile ride before they stopped to camp. The next day, as they neared Chihuahua, Price's men were met by a delegation from Chihuahua's Governor Angel Trias. The delegation informed Price that a peace treaty was in effect and all hostilities had been suspended. Like an old war horse, determined once again to experience the sound and feel of battle despite all obstacles, Price rejected Trias's information, fearing that it was only a strategy to gain time to further fortify the city. Price rushed his command forward rapidly, but when he arrived at Chihuahua, he found that Trias had evacuated the city and moved southward to avoid any confrontation. Not content with having captured the city, Price was determined to do battle. There were only enough fresh horses available to mount 250 men. Taking his small contingent, Price pressed ahead, and by March 9th, after a hard 60-mile ride, they arrived at the fortified town of Santa Cruz de Rosales, where Trias's troops were entrenched. While awaiting the arrival of the balance of his force, including his artillery and supply wagons, Price laid close siege on Santa Cruz, stating that non-combatants would be allowed to leave if they wished. Ironically, on March 10th, 1848, while Price waited to pounce on Santa Cruz de Rosales, the United States Senate, after intense debate, ratified the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. The Mexican-American War was over. Early on, the morning of March 16th, General Price, now reinforced by the arrival of three companies of regulars and a battery of cannon, demanded the surrender of the town. Governor Trias once again informed Price that he had received official word that a peace treaty had been concluded and that therefore they should not do battle. However, he said he would not surrender the town, but would defend it if forced. At 10:30 a.m., the American battery opened fire on Santa Cruz. The Mexicans returned in kind, and the cannonade went on for the best part of the day. Later, one American participant ruefully stated, "Our artillery laid to dust the work of years as it played upon their splendid churches and well-constructed houses." At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Price ordered his artillery to cease fire and pulled his troops back after he received word that a large Mexican force was coming up on his rear. That proved false, but the besieged Mexicans, thinking, as one soldier wrote, that we were whipped, shouted victory. Price decided to take the town by storm. He dismounted Gay's company and all the rest of the volunteers and placed the units on the west, south, and northwest sides of Santa Cruz. He kept his dragoons mounted to cut off any enemy escape attempts and to meet any Mexican reinforcements that might appear. A cannon was fired as the signal to attack, and the volunteers rushed the town amid loud shrieks and cheers. Major Walker's Santa Fe Battalion, in which Albert Gay was serving, charged from the south. In short order, it became obvious that fierce house-to-house fighting would be required. Every house was filled with brave Mexicans determined to defend their town. Mexican sharpshooters were posted on the roofs, behind parapets, and hastily constructed barricades. The volunteers, quickly adapting to this type of fighting, advanced on the rooftops and through the streets, breaking into houses with axes and crowbars, killing or driving the enemy out, and then using the homes as cover as they advanced. The Mexicans threw long-fused grenades at the Americans, but they had time to kick them back into enemy-held buildings before they exploded, killing the Mexican soldiers. Major Walker handed out shells from his small mountain howitzer to his men. They were able to light them and use them as hand grenades. Through the chaos of smoke, gunfire, screams of the wounded, and bursts of artillery fire, the volunteers, mostly Missourians, fought their way foot by bloody foot to the large church on the plaza in the center of town, where the main Mexican resistance was concentrated. Gay and the rest of Walker's force battled so vigorously, they were cited for having been in the lead, entering the square 15 minutes ahead of the other troops. It was sundown when they reached it and prepared to storm the church. When Major Walker's howitzer opened fire on the building, the Mexicans raised the white flag. Many Mexicans were brutally killed while attempting to surrender. The Missouri volunteers, still in a frenzy of fighting and killing, were so intent on taking the church that the American officers had a difficult time restraining them when the Mexicans gave up. Darkness soon covered the carnage, but at dawn the next morning, the horrible picture revealed itself. Bloodied and broken Mexican bodies were everywhere, in the streets, on the rooftops, in the homes. More than 250 Mexicans had died defending the town. Amazingly, the Americans had only 4 killed and 19 wounded. As a result of this unnecessary battle, fought after peace had been signed, and for no motive other than his own political advantage and personal glory, Price was acclaimed a great hero. President Polk considered the campaign one of the notable successes of the war, with Missouri newspapers filled with praise. No one seemed to question the morality of slaughtering hundreds of brave Mexican soldiers and civilians in needless combat. Perhaps Private Gay and some of his fellow volunteers who saw the results firsthand were chagrined when they later learned the battle had been without any military merit. If so, their opinions were not asked for or publicized. After the battle, Albert Gay and the other volunteers returned to Chihuahua, where they performed occupation duties. In July, they returned to Santa Fe. From there, Gay and other volunteers who were due for discharges traveled east on the Santa Fe Trail to Independence, Missouri. On October 22, 1848, Gay wrote to his parents that they arrived in Independence after a constant and severe journey of 3 months from Chihuahua. Within a year, Albert Gay became a 49er, traveling to Sacramento via the California Trail. There he made a life, establishing a farm and dabbling in other enterprises. He died in Sacramento shortly after the Civil War, while only in his early 40s. Without a doubt, he never forgot the most eventful afternoon of his life, when he and his comrades faced death in the dusty streets of a Mexican town in the battle that never should have been. True West Magazine Archives, May 1988 edition. Cattle Drive by Rory Moore. When I was 14, I thought I was a pretty good cowboy. My problem was in getting my dad to let me do something besides the ranch chores. He let me ride Hawk and Molly, and he hadn't said anything when he caught me roping the milk pen calves in the corral. But I thought I was in for it the time I was practicing riding the calves, and I saw Dad watching me through the corral fence. About then, I landed flat on my back in the dirt. The wind was knocked out of me, but the first thing I did was to look at Dad. He had seen me all right, and I tried to jump up in too big a hurry. The world whirled around, and I fell down again. That time, I stayed down for a while. Dad said, "If you ain't hurt, get up and get on him again." I got on him all right, three times, and got throwed off three times. I wasn't improving much at riding, but I was getting pretty good at landing. I wasn't hurt again. Dad turned around and went to the house. Disgusted, I guess. There were good rains that summer, and some of the big cattlemen were feeling flush. Both my dad and my big brother Bill got jobs away from home. Bill had broken a colt that spring. That was Button, a slick, trim little bay Mustang, Molly's colt, and lively as a cricket. Dad had topped him off, riding him a few times, but he was still skittish. Both Bill and Dad had warned me before they left, "You stay off Button. He ain't for kids." Later, I was sure glad Mom hadn't heard them say that. Our own cattle were on open range up toward the Chiricahua Mountains. The old buffalo wallows up there were full of water, so the cattle needn't come to the troughs to drink. My sister Marjorie and I got to ride out every so often and tally the cattle. Some of our neighbors had cattle out there, too, as did the big CCC outfit. Dad had told us, "Don't you kids go roping no big calves out there. If you find a cow bogged down or a calf with screw worms, you can come get help. An old mama cow can ram a horn clean through you or your horse." But how big was big? And anyway, the mama cow wasn't there. I caught that calf good, right around the neck, but I should have checked my cinches first. Hawk swung to face the calf on the end of the rope. When he backed up to keep the rope tight, the saddle slid up over his withers and onto his neck. I went off over his head. Lucky the calf choked down about then. I ran to tie it down and had to run back to get the piggin string off the saddle horn. I think I did it wrong. I think I tied all 4 feet from the belly side. But then the calf was about dead for air, so I had to go lead Hawk up to get the slack. That calf had screw worms in his navel. I doctored it and it got well, but I never could brag about it like I'd have liked to. I did some other damn fool things and got away with them too. Like once I jumped Hawk over a mesquite bush and he landed in a badger hole. He was up quick, unhurt. I was still going. When I lit, I still had hold of the bridle rein. Dad had taught us kids never to tie our reins together and always to hang on to one rein if we fell off a horse, unless we liked walking home, that is. Old Hawk never could be trusted to stick around once he was free of his rider. Once I climbed up the tall Northwell windmill without tying Hawk good to a post. I was up there maybe 20 minutes, gazing off across the valley, when I happened to gaze off toward home. There went Hawk, a mile away, stepping right along and holding his head to the side so he wouldn't step on the dragging reins. He was in the corral by a saddle shed when I got home. Nobody had seen him yet. I never did tell anybody I'd walk 6 or 7 miles, and I still had to chop the wood and milk the cows before night. Because I kept all such little incidents secret, I was able one day to overhear Mom say to somebody, "That Roy, he's getting to be pretty good with horses." The way that kind of flattery works is that I tried even harder to be good with horses. I had a scheme. Maybe I could get Mom to say I could ride Button. Meanwhile, I was learning some of the economics of ranching. I had heard Dad say, prices the way they are, I'd have to own 300 head of brood cows free and clear to make a living here. Since we had less than 100 head, Dad had to work away from home. And since Bill was away too, that summer I might have called myself the man of the house, except that Mom didn't exactly need one. She and my sister Marjorie could have done just about as well without me. Well, all right then, I'd look for me a job. One day, when a big dust cloud was coming down the county road, I took interest. Neighbors were driving cattle. It was afternoon and it was September. It was a drive the 20 miles to the railroad corrals in Wilcox. Mr. Reeder rode up to our yard gate. "Will somebody stand here in the gate while the cattle go by?" That was the trouble with driving cattle down lanes. There were too often gates open or fences down or cornfields without any fences at all. "We're a little short-handed," Mr. Reeder added. It hit me. I bet there were neighbor kids behind that herd. I said, "Can I go, Mr. Reeder? Can I go, Mom?" "We could use some help," Mr. Reeder said. Mom said, "But Hawk isn't here. Marjorie is riding him." "Button's right here in the little pasture," I said. "Oh, I don't know," Mom said. Her hesitation was enough. I ran to get Button. He circled the little pasture a time or two before I got him into the corral. By that time, I'd scared myself a little, thinking what he might do to me. If he bucked, no Button wouldn't buck, I hoped. In the corral with the rope, I was nervous, especially after Mom and Mr. Reeder came and watched me through the fence. I missed 3 throws. Then, because Marjorie was using the light saddle, I had to use the heavy one. Button kept circling side steps away from me, and the saddle blanket kept sliding off before I could get the saddle up. And I had to do it right and be casual about it because I was being watched. If I caused a saddle sore on Button's back, I'd be in for trouble. Finally, I got the saddle on and the blanket straight. Now came the bridle. Bill had used the hackamore in breaking Button, but Dad had put on the bridle a few times. Now, I surprised the colt. He hadn't learned to clamp his teeth together, and before he knew it, I had the bit in his mouth. He wasn't touchy about his ears, but he shied back when I tried to buckle the throat band so close to his eye. I mounted up there in the corral, and sure enough, Button reared up and tried to run, but he found no place to go. Mom said, "Now, you be careful," very sternly, when she opened the gate for me. I rode out into the lane just in time to fall in behind the herd. Fred Reeder and Virgil Baker were there, all eyes and envy to see me on a dancing horse. Charlie Neek was to be in charge, I learned. Charlie had had a college education. We couldn't expect much from him. Charles said, "You better ride here in the back till that horse settles down." Then he and Virgil rode through to the head of the herd, where they could hold the leaders back and watch for holes in the lane fence. Fred and I brought up the drag. The herd was mixed, cows and calves mostly, but some yearling steers and a couple of old bulls. Reeder's and Hutchinson's cattle were White Faces, but Ninks and Fogarty's were Holstein and Derry. The cattle weren't used to each other and they fought a lot. The wild ones ran while the tame ones poked alone. Some old cows had been up this road before, and they remembered losing their calves at the end of it. They wanted to go back home. One calf, 5 or 6 months old, was doggy and stunted and slow. Button nearly stepped on him several times. Button still wanted to run, and he was chomping at the bit. When he started buck jumping, I knew I had to let him loose. "I'll be back," I said to Fred. I slackened the reins and leaned forward just a mite, and that horse nearly jumped out from under me. I let him go. It was a mile back home, and I didn't pull up on him till we had to turn in toward the corral. I hoped he would turn. He was out of control. Sure enough, he turned, and we leaned away over on the curve. When Mom slammed the door coming out of the house, I knew I was in for it. "If you can't control that horse, get down off him. It's a good thing your dad didn't see that." "It's all right, Mom. I let him run. I forgot something. Can I take some Milo? I figure we'll get to the yards after midnight. Button will need something." "Mr. Reeder will buy some hay for the horses and for the mother cows you are going to bring back with you." "But that will be morning. I mean, for midnight. Button likes Milo." "Well, all right. Put some in the morral and take it along. I'll get you your coat. It might come up a shower." At the feed shed, I jumped off Button too quick, and he boogered sideways, jerking away from me. I was able to grab on to one rein just in time. Then I looped my lasso around his neck and held the other end while I was in the shed. The gunny sack morral hung on the wall. I dumped in a whole coffee can of Milo from the chicken feed sack. Going back to the herd, Button would have to run again, but I held him to a gallop. It was a jumpy sideways gallop and rough. It made my nose bleed. My dang nose has bled a lot of embarrassing times in my life. Mr. Reeder was there with Fred, and he told me I'd better stay home. "Oh, no," I said. "I'll be all right." "Well, if your nose bleeds any longer, you go back on home." Mr. Reeder liked little jokes. He worked up at the mascot mine, and once I heard him say, "I jumped over the fence and mascot." Of course, no women nor kids were supposed to hear that. But I had heard. So now I said, "My nose is long enough. I hope it bleeds shorter." Mr. Reeder had to get back to his job at the mine. He had been riding Bay, a big horse belonging to the Fogartys. Now he traded horses with Fred. Fred looked little up there on that big horse and in the man-sized saddle, and Mr. Reeder looked big as he headed back down the lane on old swayback Patsy. Now Charlie was in complete charge. He was a bachelor, and no doubt he felt a big responsibility in handling a herd of cattle with only 3 young boys as helpers. He needed to be up front watching for holes in the fence, but 3 times before dark, he came back to check on Fred and me. He came right down the middle of the road, scattering cattle as he came. The wild ones ran to Fred and me, and we had to head them off. Charlie would look us over for a minute and then ride back through the herd, the wild cattle running before him. I could see Virgil a mile ahead of us, chasing down the wild ones. The herd was soon strung out almost single file, and Charlie rode right on past the Kansas Settlement schoolyard gate, and the cattle streamed inside. Fred chased them out into the lane again, but by then, we were 2 miles behind the leaders. Charlie came loping. "Push them harder. Push them." It was after dark, and the moon was just coming up, when we came to a corn patch. I don't know whose corn patch it was. The fence wasn't so bad, but some of the Holsteins were hungry. I thought to myself, somebody already harvested their corn and turned their cows in. No, that looks like Fogarty's old Blossom. Then I heard a wire screech through the staples, and I realized the lane ahead was almost empty of cattle. There was no gate to open to get into the field, just sagging wires. Fred and I dismounted and knocked the wires loose from their posts. We had to break off the mesquite post to hold the wires down. Then we led our horses across. A lot of corn got trampled before we got those cattle out of there. It hadn't all been harvested, only for roasting ears. There was a dim light in a window a half mile away, and a dog barked all the time we were there. He must have been tied. Charlie came back in time to stand his horse in the hole in the fence and scare the cattle back into the cornfield. "What happened here?" he asked. "I checked this fence. You boys are going to have to fix this fence. You know that?" The cattle were passing him, going back down the road toward home. Button made a good run, heading them off. He was catching on to the cow-horse business real good. Several times that night, he turned aside to push a slow cow without me guiding him. The moon had been up quite a while when we began to hear thunder. There had been clouds on the mountains and flares of lightning, but now we began to hear thunder. Soon the moon silvered the rims of the clouds and disappeared. The first drops, hitting the brim of my straw hat, sounded like pebbles. I started untying my coat from the saddle strings, but I was all wet before I got it on. It wasn't waterproof anyway. The dust the cattle raised was soon settled, and there was a good smell to the air. Water ran off my hat and down my neck and under me on the saddle and down my legs and off my bare toes. The cattle wanted to bunch up and hump their backs, so Fred and I had to watch close not to pass any. Lightning flares now and then made it easier. It was just a small squall that soon passed over, but the distant lighting still lit up the night, and the clean smell stayed. The cattle were plodding now. I'd heard of cowboys going to sleep in their saddles, but I wouldn't have dared. Button still arched his neck and looked for an excuse to run. We hadn't seen Charlie in a long while. When the moon came out again, we could see that the lead cattle were far ahead. The smallest calves and the Dogie calf and the bony Holsteins couldn't be hurried. The Holsteins stopped dead in their tracks if we weren't right behind them. Button shied when I swung my rope, but I kept hitting those cows over their tails with it till Button forgot to shy. He learned fast, I could see that. Maybe too fast. Our dad had taught us kids never to let a horse move around while we were mounting or dismounting. Every time I got on or off Button, I slapped him lightly or jerked the rein a little if he moved. Well, I got off for personal reasons, and when I went to get on again, Button stepped aside. I spat at him with the flat of my hand and said, "Stand still." The stirrup was high for me, and I had to lift my leg a way up. Button quieted right down. He set his front hoof down on my bare foot and stood very still. Like me, Button didn't have any shoes on, and his weight pushed my toes down into the sand and held them tight. I leaned forward, pulling on the reins. I leaned backward, pulling on the reins. Button wouldn't move. He looked back at me patiently when I tried to lift his foot, but he had more weight on it. Fred would have heard if I said so much as ouch, but I was ashamed of myself. I didn't want anybody to know. It was embarrassing. I knelt down and dug sand from under my foot. Button's foot settled along with mine. I flung my arms, trying to scare Button into motion. He had sure tamed down a lot. Fred was getting far ahead. I yelled into Button's ear, "Move!" I slapped him on the belly with my open hand. My foot wasn't really hurting much, but I think I cried a little from frustration and shame. Me, who thought myself a big man. I had been there maybe half an hour when I heard someone, or something, coming up from behind. It was shapeless, but it sounded like a horse galloping. It was a horse and rider. It was Charlie. Charlie had gone into a deserted shack back down the road during the rain, and he had fallen asleep. He took hold of the bridle rein and led Button forward off my foot. Forever after, until now, I kept his secret and he kept mine.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.